You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Communicating Anthroposophy, the course for speakers to promote the idea of threefolding. Collected Works, Volume 338, translated by Rory Bradley. This is Lecture 10, the last lecture in the first part of the book. There'll be two lectures after this and then a question and answer period. This last lecture in the first part, Lecture 10, was given in Stuttgart on February 17th, 1921, in the afternoon. If you take a look around in some of the more sophisticated literature today, you will nevertheless, at least in many cases, be able to notice that all of the authors somewhere put forward an observation that goes something like this. Economists do not have to concern themselves with how people are educated or how they will fare regarding their needs. Such things must be left to the ethicists, the hygienists, and the like. I have already presented this to you from another perspective. If you take an observation like this seriously, it is nothing less than a proof of the necessity for the threefold social organism. For what are they really saying? They are saying that when you think economically, nothing results that might lead to ethics or hygiene. Rather, what leads to ethics and hygiene must come from elsewhere. If you think through the practical implications of such an observation, which until now has really been intended only theoretically, it tells you that economic judgments should be truly economic, meaning that the economy should be organized so that only those things that are actually and simply economic play into its judgments, refraining from all ethics, all hygienic concerns, and the like. And meaning also that actual institutions would exist alongside the economy and provide for the hygienic formation of an ethical social life. Those things would lie within free spiritual life. And for you, this will be an important pedagogical and didactic perspective, that you show how the foundations are really everywhere for what will lead to results when utilized properly in the threefold social organism. You can say, quote, if they really are thinking economically, the economists can think only as one must within the associative limb of the social organism, except that what is thought of in this manner will not be in books. Rather, events will occur that will carry economic thought over purely into the economy itself. Close quote. Since I want to provide more indications about methodology, I mention this today as precisely an introductory methodological remark to make you aware that when speaking about the threefold social organism, you can always start with what people have already thought of themselves. No one today has the courage to follow through the consequences of these thoughts, but the essential thing for us is to show the necessary consequences of these thoughts for social life. By the same token, you will have other questions to deal with if you direct yourself toward social life, if you familiarize yourself with the development of economic thought, you will find that in recent times a plethora of utopian ideas have appeared. As far as these utopian ideas go, we need look back only as far as the 18th century. The previous centuries are less significant for the present. But since the 18th century, a sizable number of such utopias have been thought up. Why did these utopian ideas come about? This is important for you to know so that you can allow that knowledge to flow into the whole bearing of your lectures. You see, the following is the case for spiritual life. Fundamentally, it all leads back to ancient primal wisdom and the customs associated with it. Just take, for example, the kind of totally decadent spiritual life that we have in Europe. Catholicism, on the one hand, and on the other, the incredibly watered-down modern life of Bildung, which is still flavored by old religious concepts. They are everywhere within it. You can follow those traces even into the materialistic parts of modern medicine. And in philology they are there, these offshoots of theocratic or theological thinking. So, when you really confront just how much all of modern thinking is infused with this element that leads back to ancient primal wisdom, you will understand the whole way in which spiritual life, I must now say it this way, governs itself. For it has become downright anarchic. At least when it has not been bound up tightly in the political life. You will notice that within this kind of governance, traces can be seen of things that were part of the constitutions of the territories in which this ancient primal wisdom dominated. In the church, you see it in the structure of the hierarchies. This can be traced back to the perspectives of that ancient primal wisdom. In the area of jurisprudence, you can perhaps see it only in the fight that manifests externally as the battle between materialism and the life of the spirit. In the fight being carried out now by lawyers and judges against wearing robes during judicial processes, those who support wearing the robe act out the remainder of the old thinking. Those who argue against wearing the robe display modern materialistic thinking. And this has a much greater significance than people think. And if you consider the formalities that are attached to getting a doctorate in some of our universities, you will very easily detect the traces of the old theocratic element. In all of it, we have something that has been lost to people, but that points backward to previous time, recalling a period when people actually knew how spiritual life was to be governed. Though we no longer have this spiritual life as something living in the present, we still have its forms everywhere, and even the discarded clothing, I would like to suggest, is still around. We need new forms, and we need them everywhere. They will be found in a free spiritual life. Another thing is this. In England, for example, the political democratic element developed out of the democratic element in the church. This came about in England simply through a process of stripping down the church-centered past and building up the democratic form from that. The result is that everywhere, the rights political has been born out of the theocratic religious element. One simply does not notice it as much in other places. For example, there is a secret connection in the whole bureaucratic existence at whose head one can think of the absolute leader being appointed, quote, by the grace of God, close quote. This clearly betrays its origins in theocratic religious element, for an appointment by the grace of God occurred only through an appointment by spiritual authorities. The whole body of the bureaucracy is simply the secular version of church hierarchy. The other aspect that also fundamentally developed out of the theocratic religious element is the army. People today will find this paradoxical. But the army is also nothing more than a result of the whole organization of the political entity, like a shadow that results from an illuminated object. And so, I would like to suggest, during the separation of the secular element from the theocratic religious, a certain administrating quality gradually developed within the political. This can be proved in full detail when you consider the transition of the forms of governance, how they showed themselves quite clearly in their theocratic, hierarchical form when Charlemagne placed such great value on being crowned by the Pope in Rome. One can see how church life then transitioned into the secular, how certain latecomers in this transition remained. In France, for example, high political positions were occupied by cardinals. If you think this through, you will be able to grasp quite clearly the gradual development of administrative independence in the rights political realm and the roots of this administrative element in the theocratic religious realm. You can grasp these things on your own. Now, modern economic life is moving in and has brought with it certain instinctive trading customs. But until now, nothing has been so deeply and inwardly enmeshed as the ancient hierarchical religious or political militaristic elements. These two elements have bound up the world in tight uniformity. It was in opposition to this that the impulse has recently come about to interpenetrate everything and fill it consciously with complicated economic life. That was not needed in ancient times, because people were drawing on inexhaustible sources. It has now crowded into modern life completely. The necessity has now arisen to find a certain means of administrating this economic life, but this administration has not yet been found. At the most basic level, the associative principle is the first attempt to bring something into economic life that can be drawn in parallel to the political and the religious. For the first time, there is an attempt to found something truly organically in economic life. Until now, this has not happened. All of the various theoretical attempts today to achieve a way of thinking, to organize economic life as such, have been based on utopian theories, which are always infiltrated by carryovers from the past. So people have continued to think, quote, if you organize something, then you have to organize it as in the church hierarchy or the political realm, close quote. But people were not aware of this. But people were not aware of this as they were doing it. And the practical external expression of this is the appearance of economic liberalism in the first half of the 19th century. Why did this economic liberalism suddenly crop up? What is it really? It is an appeal to individual virtue within economics. It was the same in the theocratic hierarchical element. Before you founded an organization, you had to appeal to each of the leading individuals. The same was true in the political element. Before you went over into parliamentarianism, you had to appeal to those who had the necessary capabilities to administer the political realm. Economic liberalism is nothing other than this appeal to the individual virtue of people in the economic arena. But because things in the world developed more quickly, it became more quickly necessary to find the practices that are currently paralyzing the harmful effects of absolutist individuals. You need only to study the Constitution of the Catholic Church, and you will find everywhere within the Church, which simply preserves an older administration of the spiritual life, that the administration, the institution, is based on binding and controlling the faults of individuality. In a certain sense, it is precisely because of this that individuality can be actualized. I once took part in a conversation in Vienna in which a professor of the Viennese theological faculty, who had somewhat liberal tendencies, which he indulged only in the most careful manner, complained that they made him keep his mouth shut about Rome and never allowed him to express his opinion from the lectern. The topic was discussed in detail, as was the fact that in Innsbruck, where a Jesuit was the head of the same department, this Jesuit had been allowed to speak quite openly about the same topic. And those who had some experience in such things said to themselves, quote, yes, for the Catholic Church, it is not important that, for example, exegesis be delivered freely at the university, but rather that the individuals who stand within the Church present the absolutely certain sense that they stand firm within the organization, despite their liberal perspectives. And this, of course, was something that this Jesuit achieved to a large degree. Close quote. As a result, he is allowed certain freedoms, for the organization does not destroy individuality. It is not destroyed at all. Within the church hierarchy of Catholicism, each individual is free to a large degree. But those who take things up in a way similar to Protestantism, those who make a serious affair of the dogma, they are made to keep their mouths shut. Catholicism makes a serious affair only of symbolism. There is always the danger that these questionable individuals will throw away their robes, but this cannot happen. Everything can occur within the boundaries of the Church, but no one is allowed to stand outside of it. Naturally, something like this cannot be imitated. but it can lead us to discover something characteristic of the other side. Older times appeal to the individual, but had an organization such that the individual could never be harmful to the organization. In political life, the time has already passed in which people are aware that both aspects need to be present. In economic life, it is a matter of finding the transition from economic liberalism to the associative principle. We thereby put ourselves right into the midst of what has to happen. In regard to these matters, this is precisely what the being of this world historical moment contains for us. The associative principle in economic life is nothing other than what must necessarily follow the degeneration of economic liberalism. And in modern times, because thinking is in a certain sense inactive, people have not found the courage to move into activity, to transition from liberalistic thinking to active thinking. But everywhere the attempt is being made. If you pay attention, you will have interesting experiences of this. Recently I picked up the little economic pamphlet from the Gershon collection. It addresses economic liberalism and says that the necessity arose to transition from individualistic economic forms to a form of social economic organization. And it was thereby necessary for the individual institutions to move ever more into the hands of state administration, state socialism. So not even the slightest understanding of the necessity of the associative principle, but rather state socialism. And in a different passage of this Gershon pamphlet, this one also comes from a sly devil, but not such a bad one, we find a sentence telling us that the World War has shown us that this line of thinking was correct. He means the line of thinking that said we should gradually take everything that had previously been undertaken by individuals and give it over to the state. I said to myself, quote, "Now I've got to take a look at the title page. In what year would it be possible for someone to write something like that?" Close quote. I found 1918. It was the last moment in which someone could write something like that without being called a fool. Interruption. Quote, "Excuse me, Herr Doctor, 1920. Close quote. Herr Blum shows the newest edition. You have to wonder whether it says that in the newest edition. Here it says new edition. If it is still there, it is because these things have simply remained there in 1920 in all their stupidity. Yes, indeed. He did not feel it was necessary to correct these things after 2 years. They are not clever, these sly foxes. I opened to the title page, 1918, and said to myself, quote, "Could things have been such that anyone believed that having national economics, or even city-based economics, take over the world economics of the old system was absolutely the right thing?" Close quote. I remember that at that moment the communes were teetering at the brink of ruin and would all collapse in the near future. What I want to point out is that modern thinking has not found the real proper transition from liberalistic economy to associative economy. It would perhaps be altogether impossible to really grasp the associative principle if one did not simultaneously come to know the principle of threefolding in the fullest sense. For what will work properly within the threefold social organism would have a detrimental effect within a unified state. And this must be strongly emphasized, at the very least in the nuance that you give to your lectures. For example, a person has nothing to do with threefolding who says, quote, "Well, we will just leave spiritual life to the state. We do not want a threefold social organism." But a twofold social order, something similar was even suggested in the Weimar National Assembly. Yes, a twofold order is good. That is good. Separate out economic life. Close quote. But this will never do, for the simple reason that a separate economic life, associatively organized, would necessarily have associations that are entirely dependent upon the state, and not upon people who have developed with a free spiritual life. And so economic life would always be influenced by the political. The whole of economic life would be taken over by the mentality of the political realm. By the same token, we will never, in reality, establish free schools like the Waldorf School if we allow the teachers to be taken from political institutions, so that we are always forced to have political approbation for teachers when we hire them. If someone says that we can establish a free school, but can do this only if we find state-approved teachers, this demonstrates that people have no real understanding of the situation. For this means nothing less than standing by the old, but making it look like the new. It throws sand in people's eyes. The moment is too serious for such things. What should come about in the true sense of the threefold social organism is precisely what true threefolding contains within itself, despite the danger that the resulting practical institutions might not immediately achieve success because of people's resistance to them. The most important thing today is that the idea of threefolding enters into as many people's heads as possible. Only in this way will we arrive at the quickest practical actualization of it. And now to say something about the method behind this. You cannot lecture on the idea of threefolding without laying a foundation of anthroposophical spiritual science, presented, of course, in a tactful way that is didactically and pedagogically proper. This follows necessarily from how thinking has developed in social life recently. Is it not the case that all sorts of utopias have cropped up, and that a certain system has developed which has gained widespread popularity among the proletariat, the Marxist system? To be sure, this Marxist system has taken a number of different forms. Revisionism on the one hand, Leninism on the other. This is a kind of radicalism that says, quote, "We know well that Marxism does not answer the social question, but it does result in the radical destruction of all that is extant, and after that will come a different humanity that will build anew." Close quote. But at the base of all this lies the Marxist system. Karl Marx understood well how to find a way into the souls of the modern proletariat. In a certain sense, we must even admit that this Marxism, not so much in the theory as it lived in Karl Marx, but much more in the form that it has taken on in the perspectives of the proletariat, as far as its worldview is concerned, is the most modern form of conceiving the social life. All of the others, whether they are supported by practitioners or university professors, are always somewhat backward-looking. Precisely because Marxism is the most modern form, all those who really want to do something that penetrates into society must consider it closely. It goes without saying that you cannot speak to the mass of humanity today unless you have a clear understanding, or at the very least emotionally intuitive understanding, of Marxism's significance. The core of the matter is nothing less than the fact that Marxism is the worldview and life concept that best speaks to the whole social position of the modern proletariat. And if you fight Marxism on a purely theoretical level, then you are doing something ill-suited to reality. You end up fighting Marxism without considering that everything has been allowed to get to a place in reality where the proletariat has become what it is. This can be traced back to the carelessness of the rest of the population. But as it got to the point where the proletariat became what it is today, the proletariat could do nothing other than take up Marxism as its worldview and life concept. Marxism necessarily contains within it the threefolding of human social life for the proletariat concept. By becoming a Marxist, the worker takes from Marxism the perspective on threefolding social life that is appropriate to that class. This idea is contained within it. For you see, in modern times, it is becoming increasingly customary to turn away from consumption, and the ability to see through it, and to turn one's sight toward mere acquisition. With that, the only necessity that one has is to leave behind enough from these acquisitions to allow for the administration of the social organism. Regardless of whether one has an aristocrat or a bourgeois, the acquirer was interested only in the yield of the acquisition as it related to what was received, and to how much one had to give up so that the whole could be kept together. What form did this take for people who stood in the midst of the real social organism because of old privileges or other such circumstances? They tried as much as possible always to act out of the principle of acquisition. Consumption was disregarded and taxes were agreed to, albeit with grumblings, for the sake of all that was necessary for maintaining the whole. What did the modern proletarians do? They merely stood at their machines, outside of capitalism. They disagreed with certain taxes on principle, provided they did not collapse, for they had no interest in the reality of the old social organism. They were also interested only in what was left over after acquisitions. Because they did not stand within the administration of capital, this leftover became for them merely an object of criticism, what they call surplus. The relationship of the proletariat to surplus, criticizing it, is the same one that the bourgeoisie has to taxes, which is allowed under protest. When the bourgeoisie allows taxes, it does not penetrate into what lies behind them. The proletariat does not either, but it practices criticism. It took one look at surplus and then practiced criticism. This shows nicely that it is simply a matter of adding something positive to this criticism. This would be, of course, the associative principle. But in the theory of surplus, there is something that embodies for the proletariat the economic element within a worldview and life concept. The second thing that lives in Marxist theory, insofar as it is the life concept and worldview of the proletariat, is class struggle, which according to the views of the proletariat must exist. This is the right's political element. By way of class conflict, the proletariat endeavors to fight for its rights, to organize its labor, and so on. And so the second limb of social life is there within it. It is simply the other side of what we find in the bourgeois and the aristocratic class. They do not extend beyond their class. They do not have the talent for overcoming the standards of their class and moving into what is generally human. The workers do this consciously, but of course they also take on their class. And so within Marxism we also have something that has taken the form of the right's political element in modern life. An element that has not yet found a way to transition to the truly democratic. Indeed, one that has not yet found its way to the place it must go, where all human beings who have come to maturity stand beside one another as equals in the rights political realm. This is more or less what all of the classes believe, which I have mentioned until now. When there was still an aristocratic class, let us say sometime before the French Revolution, this class was internally democratic, but anyone below that class ceased to be a human being, was no longer human in the full sense of the word. Then came the bourgeoisie. Again, within that class, everything was very democratic. But once again, everyone who was beneath that class ceased to be human. Everything in modern times is tending toward universal democracy. All of those who stand outside of the social organism, such as the proletariat, constitute their own class, opposing the others at the site of the universally human, which can be defined as the place where all people, no matter what they believe, all people who have reached maturity, conduct their affairs with each other as equals in everything that should be the concern of democratic parliamentarianism. And so in the phenomenon of class conflict, we have something that I would like to suggest must be characterized as follows. The proletariat knows that it must, insofar as it is modern, must arrive at something other than what has been there until now. But it has not learned universal humanity. Thus it takes its own class, instead of universal humanity, as its basis. And the Marxist worldview and life concept of the proletariat also have something for the spiritual element. This is precisely the materialistic understanding of history. In the materialistic age, and in the whole education of the modern proletariat, which deals only with the mechanics of life and not with the psyche or the spirit, it is quite understandable that spiritual life, from the perspective of the proletariat, became the materialistic understanding of history. But this understanding illustrates the spiritual element in accordance with its worldview and life concept. So, in proletarian Marxism, you have the most radical living expression of what modern humanity actually wants, and also why it does not know how to help itself. And you have to present something as an alternative to this that seems just as well-grounded for the proletariat as proletarian Marxism. What is the core of this proletarian Marxism as a worldview? Its core as a worldview is skepticism toward human beings. In the era of humanity's ancient wisdom, this skepticism toward humans was justified. For back then, godly forces resided within human beings and directed human actions. People knew that what came unconsciously out of the depths of their souls could be recognized as the revelations of the gods, as the directive forces for their lives. Back then, you had skepticism toward human beings and faith in the gods. When the political, administrative, the bureaucratic, militaristic elements were assembled from the older theocratic religious element, this skepticism toward human beings continued to exist. For what came about was the belief that the human being as such cannot be responsible for directing fortune. That must be done by the state. The state became a false god, an idol. And this led to the individual human being, who is now bound up in that system, to skepticism toward humans and faith in the external idol. Naturally, as the concept of God continued to decline, it became more and more idolized. Proletarian Marxism is the third and final stage of the skepticism toward the human being. The proletariat, in its materialistic philosophy of history, says, quote, "It is not the human being who directs fortune, but rather the forces of production do it. As human beings, we stand in history with our ideologies, powerless. The development of the processes of production determines the course of history, and what human beings are within these forces of production is only the result of those forces of production." Close quote. Skepticism toward humans and true faith in tangible totems. There is no fundamental difference between the African native who has moved into decadence by other means and prays to an actual chunk of wood, makes it a fetish, and the European proletariat who sees the means and processes of production as what directs the course of history. There is absolutely no logical or principal difference. It is our fantastical superstition. And we must really see this. Human beings have moved into decadence in various ways. In Africa, there was also an original ancient wisdom. Then this came under the auspices of administration. We can see this in Egypt. Then it decayed. Fetishism is not something that exists from the start, but rather something that appears in decadence. At the start, pure faith in the God exists. And only in degeneration does fetishism come about. Within civilized regions, instead of praying to physical chunks of wood, the forces of production are worshipped. Of course, the worship of them takes on different forms. But the forces of production and the process of production are made into false gods. It is the last phase of skepticism toward human beings, the phase of an economically superstitious way of thinking. There is also principally no difference between an African native worshipping an idol with an incantation and someone participating in a gathering of the modern proletariat and ranting with Marxist phrases. The prayers sound different, but we must be clear about the inner core of the matter. What must oppose this now is not skepticism toward human beings, but rather faith in them. And in the end, It is all a matter of finding this faith in people, the faith that within human beings the directive forces for life are revealed. As human beings, we must come fully to ourselves, to full self-consciousness. We must find the ability to say to ourselves, quote, "Everything external is superstition. The one and only thing that exists within us is the directive forces that must take hold in life." Close quote. For this, it is necessary to have the courage to overcome merely passive prayer and to actively pray for taking hold of the godly in our will. This transition to active prayer, to any sort of inner activity, this transition from skepticism toward human beings to faith in human beings, this is the zeal that must lie within your hearts and souls. We must feel that we are the ones who stand at the historical turning point when human beings will be led from skepticism toward human beings to faith in human beings. You do not need to say this to people, but you must step up to the podium with full consciousness of this, with the awareness that, quote, "I have to communicate to humanity that the directive forces of life must be actively grasped in our interiority, that life in the future must be so administered that people say to themselves, I must be the one who does things." Close quote. It was the final superstition of civilization that people did not have faith in themselves, but rather that they believed that the forces of production directed life. And out of this superstition came about the terrible sort of false religious ceremony in the East, where an attempt was made to take what is not governed by the soul and, nevertheless, to have the soul absorb it. The individual who unified most completely two things that do not go together, inner passivity in convictions and activity in business, is Lenin. Lenin is the person who most purely crystallized in modern times everything from the past. He crystallized most purely actualized incapacity, an actualized drive toward destruction, toward downfall. What will lead us to develop, what will lead toward a re-infusion of social life with true life forces, is finding the ability to create in people a faith in humanity out of the current skepticism toward it, a faith that finally expresses itself as follows, quote, "What I will experience as good fortune or bad, or as a social institution, or as something in external life, all these things I will do myself." Close quote. You cannot bring this to people without simultaneously strengthening them with your words. You have to bring people to a place where they have trust, where they have belief in their own being. And this is precisely what you must strive for in your hearts at the most basic level. How you do this at the moment will perhaps depend on your own capacities. But if you devote yourself with goodwill to these matters, then soon it will no longer depend on these capacities. Instead, your capacities will be seized by the necessity of these times, and you will outgrow yourself precisely by bringing this faith to people, so that faith in humanity will have to replace skepticism toward humanity. This is what I wanted to say to you before you go off to give your lectures. Feel the strength that lies within when you say to yourself, quote, "My task is to effect the transition in others from the final superstition, the final skepticism toward humanity, to faith in humanity, faith in the inner activity of the human being." Close quote. When this is your guide, you are striving toward true advancement. Everything else will lead only to a furthering of the state of decadence. There, you say to yourself, quote, "Everything in a state of decline should no longer be supported and held upright." Close quote. Instead, as far as I am concerned, look to Nietzsche. Quote, "You push it forward so that it will collapse all the more quickly, but you love not what comes from yesterday and today, but rather comes with tomorrow." Close quote. My dear friends, I would like you to go out into the world as people of tomorrow, and to imprint your words with the consciousness of people of tomorrow. That is the end of Lecture 10 and the end of the first part of this book, and there's another part 2 coming up. End of lecture 10.